There are many forms of love. The ancient Greeks spoke of agape, non-erotic love, what the Bible calls brotherly love. They spoke of eros, both in the narrow sense of phallic or sexual love, and the wider sense of love as the bonding and uniting urge of all things. The Romans spoke of amor, the complete union of one body and soul with another body and soul. These forms, and all other forms of love, for the most part varieties of these, are the living expression of the lover energy in human life. Jungians often use the name of the Greek god Eros to talk about the lover energy. They also use the Latin term libido. By these terms, they mean not just sexual appetites, but a general appetite for life. We believe that the lover, by whatever name, is the primal energy pattern of what we could call vividness, aliveness, and passion. It lives through the great primal hungers of our species for sex, food, well-being, reproduction, creative adaptation to life's hardships, and ultimately a sense of meaning without which human beings cannot go on with their lives. The lover's drive is to satisfy those hungers. The lover archetype is primary to the psyche, also because it is the energy of sensitivity to the outer environment. It expresses what Jungians call the sensation function, the function of the psyche that is trained in on all of the details of sensory experience, the function that notices color and forms, sounds, tactile sensations, and smells. The lover also monitors the changing textures of the inner psychological world as it responds to incoming sensory impressions. We can easily see the survival value of this energy potential for our distant ancestors who struggled for survival in a dangerous world. How does the lover show up in men today? How does he help us to survive and even to flourish? What are the lover's characteristics? The lover is the archetype of play and display, of healthy embodiment, of being in the world of sensuous pleasure and in one's own body without shame. Thus, the lover is deeply sensual, sensually aware and sensitive to the physical world in all its splendor. For the man accessing the lover, all things are bound to each other in mysterious ways. He sees the world in a grain of sand. This is the consciousness that knew long before the invention of holography, that we live in a holographic universe, in which every part reflects every other in immediate and sympathetic union. It isn't just that the lover energy sees the world in a grain of sand. He feels that this is so. We believe that the man accessing the lover is open to a collective unconscious, perhaps even vaster than that which Jung proposed. Jung's collective unconscious is the unconscious of human beings as an entire species and contains, as Jung said, the unconscious memories of all that has ever happened in the lives of all the people that have ever lived. But if, as Jung suggested, the collective unconscious appears to be limitless, why stop here? What if the collective unconscious is vast enough to include the impressions and sensations of all living things? Perhaps, indeed, it includes what some scientists are now calling primary awareness, even in plants. Eastern philosophers have said that we are like waves on the surface of this vast sea. The lover energy has immediate and intimate contact with this underlying oceanic connectedness. Along with sensitivity to all inner and outer things comes passion. The lover's connectedness is not primarily intellectual. It is through feeling. The primal hungers are felt passionately in all of us, at least beneath the surface. But the lover knows this with a deep knowing. Being close to the unconscious means being close to the fire, to the fires of life, and on the biological level, to the fires of the life-engendering metabolic processes. The man under the influence of the lover wants to touch and be touched. He wants to touch everything physically and emotionally, and he wants to be touched by everything. He recognizes no boundaries. He wants to live out the connectedness he feels with the world inside, in the context of his powerful feelings, and outside, in the context of his relationships with other people. Ultimately, he wants to experience the world of sensual experience in its totality. The lover energy, arising as it does out of the Oedipal child, is also the source of spirituality, especially of what we call mysticism. In the mystical tradition, which underlies and is present in all the world's religions, the lover energy, through the mystics, intuits the ultimate oneness of all that is, and actively seeks to experience that oneness in daily life while it still dwells in a mortal, finite man. The man under the influence of the lover does not want to stop at socially created boundaries. He stands against the artificiality of such things. His life is often unconventional. Consequently, because he is opposed to law in this broad sense, we see enacted in his life of confrontation with the conventional the old tension between sensuality and morality, between love and duty, between, as Joseph Campbell poetically describes it, amor and Roma, amor standing for passionate experience, and Roma standing for duty and responsibility to law and order. The lover energy is thus utterly opposed, at least at first glance, to the other energies of the mature masculine. His interests are the opposite of the warriors, the magicians, and the king's concern for boundaries, containment, order, and discipline. What is true within each man's psyche is true in the panorama of history and cultures as well. In the history of our religions and the cultures that flow from them, we can see this pattern of tension between the lover and other archetypes of the mature masculine. Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, what are called moral or ethical religions, have all persecuted the lover. Christianity has taught more or less consistently that the world, the very object of the lover's devotion, is evil, that the lord of this world is Satan, and that it is he who is the source of the sensuous pleasures, the foremost of which is sex, that Christians must avoid. The church has often stood opposed to artists, innovators, and creators. Following the ancient Hebrew practice, the church also persecuted psychics and mediums, people who, along with artists and others, live very close to the image-making unconscious and hence to the lover. Here is a source of the witch burnings of the Middle Ages. Some of the witches, as far as the church was concerned, were not only psychic, that is, deeply intuitive and sensitive to impressions from the inner world of nuanced feelings, but they were also nature worshippers. Because the church labeled the world of nature evil, the witches were believed to be worshippers of Satan, the lover. Archetypes cannot be banished or wished away. The lover crept back into Christianity in the form of Christian mysticism. The doctrine of the incarnation itself proclaims God's permanent and intimate intercourse with all human beings. It is the presence of the lover in Christian mystical experience and theological thought that underlies the church's ambivalent but nonetheless sacramental view of the material universe. What ways of life manifest the lover most clearly? There are two primary ones, the artist and the psychic. The artist is sensitive and sensual. Artists live very close to the fiery power of the creative unconscious. In a similar way, genuine psychics also live in a world of sensations and vibrations, of deeply felt intuitions. Their conscious awareness, like that of the artist, is extraordinarily open to invasion from other people's thoughts and feelings and from the murky realm of the collective unconscious. They seem to move in a world behind or beneath the world of daylight common sense. From this hidden world they receive, often in the form of almost audible words, gusts of strong feelings, unaccounted-for smells, sensations of heat and cold not accessible to others, images of great horror and beauty, and clues about what is really going on with other people. The businessman who has hunches is also accessing the lover. So are we all when we have premonitions and intuitions about people, situations, or our own future. In those moments, the underlying unity of things is revealed to us, even in mundane ways, and we are drawn into the lover energy which connects us with realities of which we are not normally aware. Any artistic or creative endeavor, and almost every profession, is drawing upon the energies of the lover for creativity. All of us, when we stop doing and just let ourselves be and feel without the pressure to perform, are feeling the lover. Of course, we feel him strongly in our love lives. In our culture, this is the main avenue most of us have for getting in touch with the lover. Many men literally live for the thrill of falling in love, that is, falling into the power of the lover. In this ecstatic consciousness, which comes to even the most hard-boiled of us, we delight in our beloved and cherish her in all her beauty of body and soul. Through our emotional and physical union with her, we are transported into a divine world of ecstasy and pleasure on the one hand, and pain and sorrow on the other. The whole world looks and feels different to us, more alive, more vivid, more meaningful. This is the work of the lover. A man living in either pole of the lover's shadow, like a man living in any of the shadow forms of the masculine energies, is possessed by the very energy that could be a source of life and well-being for him if accessed appropriately. As long as he is possessed by the shadow lover, however, the energy works to his destruction and to the destruction of others around him. The most forceful and urgent question a man identified with the addicted lover asks is, why should I put any limits on my sensual and sexual experience of this vast world, a world that holds unending pleasures for me? There are the so-called addictive personalities, people who can't stop eating or drinking or smoking or using drugs. The addict lives for the pleasure of the moment only and locks us into a web of immobility from which we cannot escape. This is what the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr talked about as the sin of sensuality. Here's where we see the Don Juan syndrome. Monogamy can be seen as the product of a man's own deep rootedness and centeredness. He is bounded not by external rules, but by his own inner structures, his own sense of his masculine well-being and calm, and his own inner joy. But the man moving from one woman to another, compulsively searching for he knows not what, is a man whose inner structures have not yet solidified. Because he himself is fragmented within and not centered, he is pushed and pulled around by the illusory wholeness he thinks is out there in the world of feminine forms and sensual experiences. For the addict, the world presents itself as tantalizing fragments of a lost whole. Caught in the foreground, he can't see the underlying background. Caught in the myriads of forms, as the Hindus say, he can't find the oneness that would bring him calm and stability. Living on the finite side of the prism, he can only experience light in its dazzling but fractured rainbow hues. This is another way of talking about what ancient religions called idolatry. The addicted lover unconsciously invests the finite fragments of his experience with the power of the unity, which he can never experience. The restlessness of the man under the power of the addict is an expression of his search for a way out of the spider's web. The man who is possessed by the web of Maya is twisting and turning, frantically struggling to find a way out of the world. But instead of taking the only way out there is, he struggles and deepens his predicament. This happens because what he thinks is the way out is really the way deeper in. Psychologists talk about the problems that stem from a man's possession by the addict as boundary issues. For the man possessed by the addict, there are no boundaries. As we've said, the lover does not want to be limited, And when we are possessed by him, we cannot stand to be limited. A man possessed by the addicted lover is really a man possessed by the unconscious, his own personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. He is overwhelmed by it as if by the sea. This oceanic chaos, the unconscious, is, as we have seen, imaged in many mythologies as feminine. It is mother. We can see then how the shadow lover as addict is a carryover from childhood into adulthood of the absorption into the mother of the mama's boy. The man under the power of the addict is still within the mother, and he's struggling to get out. He must learn that his lack of masculine structure, his lack of discipline, his resulting affairs, and his authority problems will inevitably get him into trouble. What happens if we feel that we are out of touch with the lover in his fullness? We are then possessed by the impotent lover. We will experience our lives in an unfeeling way. We will describe symptoms that psychologists call flattened affect, lack of enthusiasm, lack of vividness, lack of aliveness. We will feel bored and listless. We may have trouble getting up in the morning and trouble going to sleep at night. We may find ourselves speaking in a monotone. We may find ourselves increasingly alienated from our family, our coworkers, and our friends. We may feel hungry but lack an appetite. Everything may begin to feel like the passage in the biblical book of Ecclesiastes that declares, "All is vanity and a striving after wind," and "There is nothing new under the sun." In short, we will become depressed. People who are habitually possessed by the impotent lover are chronically depressed. They feel a lack of connection with others, and they feel cut off from themselves. We see this in therapy often. The therapist will be able to tell from the expression on the client's face or from his body language that some feeling is trying to express itself. But if we ask the client what he is feeling, he will have absolutely no idea. He may say something like, "I don't know, I just feel there's this kind of fog. Everything is just hazy." This often happens when the client is getting too close to really hot material. What happens then is that a shield goes up between the conscious ego and the feeling. That shield is depression. But we all know that when we're depressed, that we just don't have the motivation to do the things we either want to do or have to do. This frequently happens to the elderly. Their physical problems, isolation, and lack of useful work plunge them into depression. The zest for life is gone. The lover seems nowhere to be found. Pretty soon, these older men stop fixing meals for themselves. They feel that there's nothing to live for. The Bible says that without a vision, the people perish. It is specifically without the imaging and visioning of the lover that people perish. But it isn't just the lack of a vision that signifies the oppressive power of the impotent lover in a man's life. This man's sex life has gone stale. He is sexually inactive. Such sexual inactivity may stem from any number of factors. Boredom and lack of ecstasy with his mate, smoldering anger about his relationship, tension and stress on the job, money worries, or the sense of being emasculated by the feminine or by the other men in his life. In conjunction with the impotent lover, this man is either regressed into a pre-sexual boy, or he is mainlining either the warrior or the magician, or a combination of the three. His sexual and sensual sensitivity has been overwhelmed by other concerns. As his sexual partner becomes more demanding, he withdraws even further into the passive pole of the lover's shadow. At this point, the opposite pole of the archetypal shadow may rescue him by propelling him into the addict's quest for the perfect satisfaction of his sexuality beyond the mundane world of his primary relationship. If we are appropriately accessing the lover, but keeping our ego structure strong, we feel related, connected, alive, enthusiastic, compassionate, empathic, energized, and romantic about our lives, our goals, our work, and our achievements. It is the lover, properly accessed, that gives us a sense of meaning, what we've been calling spirituality. It is the lover who is the source of our longings for a better world for ourselves and others. He it is who is the idealist and the dreamer. He is the one who wants us to have an abundance of good things. I have come to bring you life, that you might have it more abundantly, says the lover. The lover keeps the other masculine energies humane, loving, and related to each other and to the real life situation of human beings struggling in a difficult world. The king, the warrior, and the magician, as we've suggested, harmonize pretty well with each other. They do so because without the lover, they are all essentially detached from life. They need the lover to energize them, to humanize them, and to give them their ultimate purpose, love. They need the lover to keep them from becoming sadistic. The lover needs them as well. The lover without boundaries, in his chaos of feelings and sensuality, needs the king to define limits for him, to give him structure, to order his chaos so that it can be channeled creatively. Without limits, the lover energy turns negative and destructive. The lover needs the warrior in order to be able to act decisively, in order to detach with the clean cut of the sword from the web of immobilizing sensuality. And the lover needs the magician to help him back off from the ensnaring effect of his emotions, in order to reflect, to get a more objective perspective on things, to disconnect, enough at least to see the big picture and to experience the reality beneath the seeming. Tragically, the unrelenting attacks on our vitality and on our shining begin early in our lives. Many of us may have so repressed the lover in us that it has become very hard for us to feel passionate about anything in our lives. The trouble with most of us is not that we feel too much passion, but that we don't feel our passion much at all. We don't feel our joy. We don't feel able to be alive and to live our lives the way we wanted to live them when we began. We may even think that feelings, and in particular our feelings, are annoying encumbrances and inappropriate for a man. But let us not surrender our lives. Let us find the spontaneity and joy of life inside ourselves. Then not only will we live our lives more abundantly, but we will enable others to live, perhaps for the first time in their lives.